Welcome back to Quick Coco. On the podcast today, it is my greatest honor to introduce our next guest. She is an international speaker, performer, writer, curator, activist, and storyteller. She is the legend Amal Leotelu. Welcome to the show.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. Oh, so I'm so excited to be on this show. Like, serious. Like, I have my girly mode right here sitting in this chair.
But for our listeners, I just wanted to say that I've wanted to have you on for the longest time. We did speak before this, but yeah, again, it's my greatest honor to have you on. You are a legend in our community, and I hope that people give you your flowers while you're here, and you deserve everything. But on that note, how are you? Like, how's everything going on in Melbourne with, like, the lockdown easing and things like that?
I'm good. I think if we went into any more of these restrictions, I don't know. I think Melbourne had the toughest in the world. It was unreal to see other places around, you know, like Queensland. And I thought to myself, oh my God, I feel like moving to Queensland during COVID, because it was just like seeing people out and about. And, you know, here it was just like, oh no, we're tied to our houses.
Yeah,
I'm good. It's just work at the moment for me, like the private work that I do has been really busy, but it's just nice to have a lot more freedom than, say, what we've had in the last 9 months. As I was saying, Melbourne must have had the strictest in the world. Yeah. You know, it was just like there were no shops open, or you couldn't go visit your friend, even to, you know, this thing of physically touching people. It was just like, so, you know, sometimes I looked at it and I thought, oh, Pasifika people, we're physical people.
Yeah.
You know, these things of Zoom links and that, it doesn't really cut it. So, you know, I'm good at the moment. Work for me is busy. But yeah, like the majority of the whole world, you know, can't wait for 2020 to be over.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
So for our listeners, are you able to talk a little bit about where you come from? We know where you live. Your village is in Samoa. You are Samoan, right?
yes. Okay. Well, I'm New Zealand born. I was born in Auckland. I grew up as a young child in Otara, and then migrated over. You know, that's where all the talent is.
Oh, right.
And then, and then we migrated as in 82, 83 as a 12, 13 year old. And then I went back 2 years later. So I've kind of spent half my life in New Zealand and half in Australia. Grew up in Sydney in the areas of Canterbury, Bankstown. And then I came to Melbourne 2003 and I came for the weekend and fell in love with Melbourne. I looked at the grass and I thought, coming from the airport, I was like, oh my God, it's green. And then just decided to make Melbourne my home. Although through the COVID stuff, I was just like, oh, I think I need to move to Queensland.
I think even introverts were struggling through that.
Oh, yeah. It was crazy. But yeah, I grew up half in New Zealand and half in Australia. I consider New Zealand as my second home. And my parents are from Savai'i, so the beautiful island of Savai'i. And my Safoku, which is my mum's village, and Ava, which is my dad, so neighboring villages.
Ooh, scandalous.
Yeah, talk about scandalous. Yeah, 10 children later, scandalous, all right. But I had the good fortune to go to Samoa, and I hadn't been in over 35 years, and I went three, absolutely loved it. You know, yeah. It's just like, oh my God. And I actually wish I was in Samoa at the time of all this, because I was like, there's no COVID cases in Samoa, you know, at the present time. And it was just like oh my God, you know, I think what I loved when I was there was just people's receptive attitudes towards whawhawhinge.
Yeah.
You know, like here we've got the we've got the money, we've got the da-da-da-da-da, but over there, you know, they're just happy and they laugh. They're constantly mm-hmm. laughing. Yeah. And then, you know, they're not laughing at us. They're laughing with us. It's a yeah. whole, it's a whole different take to Western so context here.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's, I, for me, it's a struggle here. It's a yeah. struggle to, you know, to like, you know, like, yeah, we, you know, like I said, we've got the shops that we can go to get cheap, you know, food or eat it. We can go out, eat out. We can have a roof over our heads. But I said, the mental struggles that queer people face, you know, here, you know, I look at my Balangi counterparts and, you know, for them, you know, for us, our big support networks are our families.
Mm-hmm.
You know, with a lot of my Balangi trans friends, they've had families that disown them because of these. Yeah. You know, that's huge.
Yeah.
You know, and I think to myself, wow, you're in a privileged country that has these opportunities, yet you're still discriminated against quite yeah. heavily. So and those are kind of the things. Sorry.
No, and for us, we're brown, and so we have to battle both of those things. So we have to battle within our own community and then the outside world. And yeah, as you were yeah. saying off camera, like it's twice as hard for us.
Yeah, we have to put in job. And you know what? We have to get, you know, we get up and we rise to the occasion, you know, the majority of us. And what I love about being around queer people of color, you know, Pasifika, we still have that sense of humor that is able to pick us up on a bat. I absolutely love that. I miss it a lot.
Yeah.
Because, you know, my dealings are with Balangis and these, you know, spaces that we have to go educate them. And it's really serious. And sometimes I think to myself, you know, like I just want to yeah. crack it. You know, like, you know, I just said, it just...
They have no idea sometimes.
Oh, they have no idea. And then when you tell them your queer Pasifika story, they get amazed because they think, my God, look how easy, you know. I said, oh, it's, you know, we still have our challenges, but we still have our framing is a whole lot different. What I love from the Pasifika thing is, I think it's this thing of being an indigenous community, you know, Pasifika group of people is that we do this thing of connecting quite easily. We look at everybody quite universal as a family. That's huge. That is yeah. huge, especially when you're even looking at Balangis as family. And I said, that's quite a healthy thing mentally wise, because, you know, you're not looking at them as an outsider. You're wanting to engage them as, look, I got a lot of love for you, my friend,
mm-hmm.
you know, and I want to hear what you're, you know, we have that empathy.
Yeah.
And I always see it in a lot of the indigenous people, just they have this connection, and it's hard to describe to Balangians because you know, when you go try and tell them, oh, I'm doing it out of love, and they like, oh, I don't know about that.
You didn't
love,
invoice
honey.
Him?
Yeah, exactly. You know what I'm saying? Sugar bye, honey, darling. You know, yeah, it's hard case. And then they look at you, go, and you're like centered in yourself, go, oh, it's natural. We just do it as Pasifika people. We look after everybody.
Yeah.
You know, and that's one of the things that I am able to, you know, gives me leverage, or I'm able to take to the table when I deal with these Balangis, is going, I'm going to frame the context from a Pacific, you know, frame, and that we're not so hard up in yeah. the way where, you know, when we meet people, we're like, oh no, what's your name, or what's your story? You know, that open empathy, which yeah. I find in a lot of the Western stuff, it misses. And I just said, yeah, and look at the trouble that we're in, mm-hmm. you know, when at the way they've framed it, you know, we're yeah. so used to this colonial way of thinking and that, and look how screwed up half of our world is.
Absolutely. Yeah. And like, they're so individualistic in their approach to
yeah.
life. And even within their own families, like, it's kind of transactional, like, almost all the time. Yeah.
Yes, yes. So, yes.
I wanted to ask you as well, when did you know that you were fa'afafinge or trans?
I think, from a very young age, and the way I looked at it was because I've never really had this coming out. I've always thought I had to come out. But the funniest thing with me, when I explain to, you know, Balangis, they go, oh, when was your coming out? And I said, oh, I never had a coming out. I came out of my mum's stomach. That was my coming out. You know, because, you know, as an Islander, when you look at it, we're like, oh, we just evolve. Because, you know, our families are not looking for this thing of, oh, you need to tell us, you need to make up a kind of a production or an engagement to tell us. We just evolve. Mm-hmm. So, you know, with my own family, I've always had this thing in the back of my mind, because it was a, you know, that kind of Balangi way of thinking, you have to have this big coming out. But when I realised, you know, just the way that Amal has evolved, I didn't really have to, you know, they just go, you know, when they eventually were hooked onto, you know, knowing about Amal, they go, oh, we already knew.
Yeah.
You know, and so you know, I had this big ass anxiety anticipation. Oh my God, it's going to be at the time that I have to tell them. I think for me, it was at a young age, but you don't know how to describe it because you're kind of scared to tell them in one way because you think they won't understand. And for me at the time, back in the 70s and 80s, there was still a hatred towards people that were different or considered themselves to be in the rainbow acronym because of the, you know, once upon a time, the AIDS epidemic was quite huge. And there was this, I don't know if you've seen that ad of the bowling alley ad where it was the Reaper, what you call it, thing. And it was quite scary as a young child to see that they made this big ad about, you know, people to be aware of AIDS. But just the discrimination that people were facing just for the fact that they may have succumbed was quite scary because there was so much hate and people didn't want to touch you. Or people didn't want, you know, this is like, people, you know, that were working in the medical stuff, and to see that hate displayed quite universal is just like, you know, so why would anybody want to come out? Whereas now it's a lot more, it's okay, it was, you know. But for me, I felt it was at a young age, but I learned to kind of explore my sexuality or my gender during my teenage years where, you know, sneaking off to King's Cross with my cousins, they're not knowing, they didn't really care. But it was a way for me to explore outside my good AOG life.
Oh, she's AOG.
I did the whole shebang. I went from being, you know, we're originally Methodist.
Yeah.
And then we ended up being AOG. But, you know, to be in a church situation in the 80s with all that discrimination going on was quite heavy. And so it's a scenario of you do what you have to do safe, but I also needed to explore myself. So I was very fortunate to have some good friends and good cousins that allowed me to go out or would sneak me out to clubs, and then I could go and express myself any way that I choose to. And at the time, if I'd go out with my straight, hetero, masculine cousins, I would have, I was lucky in the fact that they were quite tough. So all their Greek and Italian friends never gave me any trouble if Amal happened to act feminine. But it was just for what the culture was back then to what it is now. And so, whereas I find I'd be a lot comfortable coming out now, but back then it was a lot more secretive. And, you know, when I look at some of the horrific and traumatic experiences that some of our LGBTIQ community had succumbed to.
Yeah.
You know, the reason why Stonewall, you know, when you look at that scenario, you know, it was just a case of being safe and being allowed. But I think for myself, I knew at a very young age, but it was just a case of, I don't know what to make of it. And I mm-hmm. just want to be safe because I'm scared. I'm just scared. I'm scared yeah. of, you know, how family will react. And then, you know, going to a church that was very, you know, very charismatic and very strict in their way of doing things.
Mm-hmm.
So adding that on top of, oh, you're trying to find yourself as a 14, 15 year old because you know you're acting, your mannerisms are different or you're liking the same sex.
Yeah.
So those things are challenging. But it was always in the back of my mind. And when my cousins in there realized, they go, oh, we, you know, this is the hard case thing about it. It's like when they've got this attitude, oh, we already knew.
Yeah.
Want some supper soy or gano now, you know, like.
That's that exactly it.
You know, are you hungry? What do you want? Yeah.
And you've been like staying up all night trying to think if you're going to say it or if you're not going to say it. And then they're just so casual.
Yeah. Yeah, it's in the back of your mind. But, you know, those contributing negative factors in the past were why, you know, being apprehensive to, you know, like, especially in my teenage years, you know, and then, you know, having guys in my boys only school, you know, passing homophobic thing, but it wasn't just joking wise. It was just like, we're going to beat you if we find out that you are gay. Mm-hmm. You know, that kind of, it's just, so it's, you're trying to play it safe. Whereas now it's a lot more, you've got a lot more young people that are a lot more accepting of it if they find out different. But back then, it was the case, oh, no, I'm not gay, you know, or I, you know. And so, yeah, but it was always been there, like, you know, and I'm just very fortunate that I've got family members that are LGBTIQ, so it's encouraging them or supporting those younger members to, you yeah. know, that they will always be loved and that they have a place on this world. You know, they have a place in this society.
Yeah. On that note, though, so how supportive have your family been with your journey?
Oh, really supportive. I think from them, I used to have this expectation, just like the anxiety of having to come out to them or explain. And I've always felt I needed to explain to them. But as I evolved, I realized, oh, they just love me for me. And they've actually said it to me, like in terms of, we love you. You can't beat that. You know, and I've never had to really explain myself to them.
Yeah.
It's just, you know, and I also came with the realization, I actually don't expect them to understand because for them, it's also having to change their thing. But the fact that they just give me love, mm-hmm. that's enough. That's yeah. enough. And my understanding is with them. And, you know, I'm the youngest, or biologically the youngest of 10. And so, you know, I have this confidence now, whereas, you know, if I have to explain to them, I will. But then they're not looking for me to explain. I think that's a consolation for me, is the fact that because it gets tiring of
yeah.
having to tell people, da 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 da. I was talking to someone yesterday about what it is to date for a trans person.
Yeah.
And even navigating that is a challenge. It's huge. It's just like, you know, it's one of the things for me is that I fear having to disclose who I am, you know, because it's just like, oh, will they still love me for me? Mm-hmm. Will they still want to be with me if I had not mentioned trans? I prefer to tell a potential partner if I am, but it's a challenge and those kind of things. So having family, you know, not having to explain myself in excess of who I am or what I am, but it's just knowing that they say to me, we love you regardless. And I, you know, that love that they give me is put into actions. You know, when I go to family things, they don't, you know, there's no put downs. You know, it's a single, you feel it, you sense it. And it's a wonderful thing, especially for a queer Pacifica person who we get the, you know, we get the challenges from our Western culture, you know. And so to, you know, my family means the world to me. And so to know that they're, you know, they're supporting me is a big thing, because I think to myself, well, that's half of my worries. Yeah. You know, that's half of my I don't need to worry about that. And that's a huge thing, because they're, you know, they're the backbone of my support, you know, they're my support as well, you know, because I look at my Balangi, a lot of my trans Balangi counterparts, you know, and I see the disengagement or the sadness or the challenge, the challenges they face with not having the support from people who they considered their loved ones. Mm-hmm. I think to myself, I don't really know how I feel if I would lose my family, you know, but I can only make, you know, I don't know, like to assume, but I would think to myself, that's a huge kick in the back, you know, to not have the people that you thought, you know, like your blood, you know, and they've just
love you unconditionally.
Yeah, and they've just dissed you to the curve, like you know.
I was gonna say we're only like a few years apart, and I feel like with there's a big difference in people that came after you that are queer and in our community. Like we're asked, we ask our parents to change their thought process on like. In such drastic ways to accept us, to know more about us, and then but we don't kind of give them grace to like we don't give them time to do it. And so I really appreciate what you said about not like I think some listeners will think it's a bit old-fashioned, but I do appreciate that like all they need to do is love you, and that's what's at the core of all of it.
I just, you know, like when I speak on the various panels, I, you know, it's Balangis go, you know, they get amazed like my approach, but I just said it's just the way I've been brought up, like it's just like my family, you know. And it's hard to describe to a Balangi, because you know their kind of love sometimes is a whole different, theirs, you know, like theirs is a kind of different way of approach, whereas ours is a lot more central in terms of, you know, no matter what negative say, we still love each other. You know, like I was saying to somebody the other day, we're not a culture that's good at cutting people off.
No.
You know, because, you know, Balangis can do it quite, you know, like that.
Yeah.
And you know that I find that that kind of mental way of thinking works for us in terms of the way we still connect with our loved ones, the way we're still able to have that. And so for me, that's what gives me leverage in terms of my own connections that I have just in general with people, in ways I work with people. Is I may not necessarily agree with you, but doesn't mean I have to dish you, you know, like cut you off. Mm-hmm. I still care. I still want to know that you're eating. You know, I still want to know that your mental well-being is okay. And that, you know, like I was saying, there's a huge, these huge benefits in that kind of approach, in that approach that we get from Pacific Islanders when we taught to look out for one another. I see it quite universal in terms of my LGBTIQ extended family. You know, and my Balangi friends go, what? You know, they kind of do a double take, because it's just like, oh, you're not even trying to give us love. You're just, you exuberate it.
Yeah.
You know, and I just said, yeah, but it's just, it's like, you know, and it, I look at it as it's their way that they're so used to framing, whereas us, it's a natural thing, you know, like I remember when my friends would come over and my dad would go, alofese ipuki, you know, like roll my eyes, like go and feed your friends, you know, you know, that kind of empathy to go, hey, look out for your friend.
Yeah.
So I feel grateful in that respect. I hold it dear to my heart because if I didn't have my Pasifika ways in general, I would feel lost. Because I feel it's such a hard thing to be an LGBTIQ person, especially a trans woman of color, like that, like just, I don't know, I would feel like, oh, I don't know how I would deal with not having my family love me or my connection.
Yeah.
You know, but it's just a whole different approach. And it's just, I'm so humbled to have that cultural identity that I speak highly of, because I think there's a lot of things that the Palangi world could learn from us, or that we could learn from other cultures,
mm-hmm.
that, you know, that is a therapeutic and a great mental way of making you a better person, or of making you, just being able to be strong and rise up to any occasion, negative occasion that may be thrown at you.
Yeah. Oh. So I think it was a couple of weeks ago now, some things happened online with the trans community and people making very disparaging comments about one of our sisters online. I wanted to ask you, how do you deal with things that you see online that are possibly traumatic for you?
Sometimes if it is, I try not to give power to the, I'm going to use the word, you can beep it up, BS that people throw at us, because sometimes if you give...
Oh, you can say anything you want.
Oh, great, the bullshit that's thrown at us. Sometimes it's too much energy to try and control. You can say whatever, but sometimes you also have to look out for your mental well-being. So, you know, this year more than any year, I found this year I really have to, you know, I've had to look at my own mental well-being, because such things as the deaths of trans women of colour in the US, you know, seeing my feed bombarded with, the deaths, but also the way that trans people have been treated. So the way that I deal with, there's like everything, you have a choice. You have a choice to deal with it and take it on board, or you have a way to find ways to, you can, you know, deal with it the other way. I try best the way that I can deal with it, because, you know, I don't talk on anybody else's behalf, but a lot of my advocacy work is to do with trans advocacy. So if I know I've got a way of getting in there, what I've been mindful of is my, like I said, my own mental well-being, because, you know, a lot, as you know, with social media, a lot of people can easily attack you,
mm-hmm.
you know, so I take on what I can take on, and if I can't take it on, then just a mau, you will have to drop it. There's 25 other people that are already having their say. So, yeah, it's just, I've just found you have to, if you're not mindful, you have to take care of your own mental well-being.
Yeah.
Because sometimes it's so easy to get swept up into, confrontational stuff. But sometimes if you're not wary, it can also take you down.
Mm-hmm.
And so you have to be aware of what energy you can give or what you can do, and be mindful of your own energy, because you want to wake up the next day knowing that you can go to work, that you can deal with the next crisis in the best way that you can, you know, the next day. Because sometimes, you know, as you've seen with social media stuff, it can be overwhelming. And, you know, me, you know, going into my 50s, you know, I don't have the same energy that I had 20 years ago, to give. So my mental well-being is important, but it's also looking out for my other trends. You know, if it means things, I think for me, the when I do my advocacy things or go into meetings with organizations, I'm interested in seeing the way that organizations change up their policies and procedures in terms of welcoming people like queer people of color to their spaces. That for me is important, because that writing, you know, things in writing, you know, legally is important, just mm-hmm. so that people like you and I have protections when we go into some of these straight organizations that have no understanding of queer people. And so that's where I'm really interested is engaging in conversations that are able to change up the policies and procedures that make places safe for you, people like yourself and I, to go into, to utilize things like their services. Yeah. Because at the end of the day, you know, if we go and utilize something, we need to be mindful that, you know, is it a, you know, like everything else, is it a safe space for us to go?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
you brought up an interesting point before, and we spoke a little bit about before we started recording. Something I've learned this year, not only from the trans community, but also from Black Lives Matter. I used to be like, why aren't they saying something? Like, people are attacking them. Why aren't they speaking up for themselves? I've learned that people are exhausted of defending themselves for something that they can't help. And I've seen it so much. So I think it's our time, because I do have some privilege as a gay man to be a voice. And it's so cliche now, like people say that all the time, but it really is true to what we have to do.
You're so right. Like, even I have a privilege as a trans woman of color here in Australia. You know, I look at my counterparts globally or in the US. You know, they're actually picked on quite huge. I'm lucky. This Aussie is quite a safe space for someone like myself. I might get the odd da da da, but not to the point where, you know, they're getting shot or they're getting killed. So, like you, you know, it's utilizing the privilege that we have as privilege, you know, however you perceive that, to utilize that platform to speak up. And that's where my energy comes from, is like having this privilege here of being a lot more safer than my counterparts globally to be able to speak up, because I'm safer to speak up here than if I was in another, you know. The trans woman of color deaths in the US this year were huge, like that 350, I just said, you know, it's, you know, like Brazil has the highest.
Yeah, and those are the ones we know of too.
Yeah, those are the, you know, that's a consolation, like we know of those deaths. But, you know, like globally, like the way people are treated for being trans or a third gender is just like, it's horrific. Like, it's horrific. You know, so, you know, I'm quite lucky in the fact that this is my privilege, that I'm here living and breathing, even, you know, even though, you know, and it's up to my people like myself to utilize that platform to speak up. Like you said, you know, it does get tiring. Like this year, prior to the COVID thing, we're going into lockdown. And I said to my friend, after being in so many years in, you know, I was just tired. Like I just had no more energy to give, because it was the same thing of telling the same story. And so now one of the things I do with Balangis that I deal with is make sure, you know, encouraging them to do the homework, you know, not me having to constantly explain what whawhawhinga is, you know, my one, Google it, you know, go, you know, for them to do the homework.
Yeah.
You know, because they go, wow, this, I just said, yeah, wow, but go do the homework. You know, go educate yourself. You know, wow, go educate yourself as well. You know, like, it's just like, because we're constantly doing it.
Yeah.
You know, and I just think to myself, no, you go and do some homework.
Yeah.
You go learn about my, you know. Oh, are you there?
Yeah.
You go learn about my culture. You go do some, you know, revising over what it is for this person to be a Samoan in a Western culture.
Mm-hmm.
So it's just finding out ways you can use your power, you know, what your so-called power of privilege would be, and being able to, execute, you know, like how I was saying, like, no, you go and do your research, you know. Mm-hmm. But, you know, in terms of what I do, it's, you know, just like the work that you put into researching your thing, you know, it comes over this thing of just, you know, the work that you have put in, like it hasn't come through just going, oh, I picked up a book and then I was blessed with all these blessings.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's just like, it's just like, you know, some people don't get it. But yeah, it's just using that power of privilege. And for me, it's being in a Western culture that allows me to have a lot of safety to do things here.
Mm-hmm. What has been, I'm sure there's been so many things, but what has been the most challenging situation that you've been in as a trans woman?
I think just for me was affirming myself into, you know, going into spaces, you know, going into organizations and looking for employment, and that, you know, like for trans people, three things: housing, employment, health, which really can, you know, affect anybody's well-being. But for a trans person in particular, those three things, housing, health and employment, are quite huge. So for my own personal journey, navigating that has been a huge challenge, because I've really had to really affirm or fight for my ways to, you know, like even things like to get jobs and that, you know, and you're going through a transitional period, can be a hard one to navigate. You know, if, say, you weren't born that gender at birth, you're going through the transitional period, yet you need to have employment, yet you need to try and find money. If you don't have employment, you know, you need to have a roof over your head. So, yeah, those, you know, just the challenge of being a trans person in Australia has been a huge, you know, it's almost like it's been, and you know, like, I don't know how I've done it, but I've just had to really apply myself. But it's always been the thing that I've woken up with: have to apply yourself today to get on and find where you're going to stay, or find your food for today. Yeah, and it's you know, like how I was saying, that leverage of my cultural identity gives me a safe, gives me a comfort. Yeah. But you know, doing things on my own for the last, say, 15 years, I've really had to apply myself. And in terms of the three things that I said, the housing, the employment, health, for a trans person, like, I think for anybody, if you don't have that, you're basically screwed, you know, like in a Western culture. And so a lot of trans people, those are three difficult things that, those are three things that they have to navigate. And I think that's quite cute. You know, that's just, you know, when you look at it, just like, my God, it's just somebody that's just needing to live. And that's my, that's been my challenge.
Yeah.
Is the thing of needing to live every day in, you know, in a society that hopefully gives me, you know, allows for me the freedom to access services quite easily, that allows me to have housing, that allows me to have health, that allows me employment. I think for me, it's just that it's a case of just living. That's been my greatest challenge, because more than anything, you know, it's just, as it, it's so hard. I just, it's been so challenging to navigate, you know, through, you know, through this Western culture that we live in.
Yeah. You mentioned a transitional period before, and I hate focusing on physical aspects of the trans experience and things like that, but can I ask you what bugs you the most about, like, questions people ask you when it comes to your transness?
Or just the staring, or the, you know, when you so-called don't pass in people's eyes, or their perception of, you know, womanhood, or physical beauty. My negative experiences that have come from that is being spat on twice on public transport. And, you know, and, you know, I had to do, you know, the guy blurted out one time, why do you look like what you look like? And I'm like thinking, but I couldn't speak up because it was five of his male aggro friends compared to myself. Those kind of things are really, you know, make it hard. Like, even the thing of how I said to you earlier on about dating, you know, having to go into dating situations or look at potential dating and go, what information do I disclose for my own safety?
Yeah.
You know, for a trans person, it's this thing of safe, you know, being safe, you know, but you're constantly hammering it in yourself.
Yeah.
But, you know, the challenge of, that was one of the challenges, you know, is people staring, or, you know, whereas I never really had that from my own Pacific community, you know, like, you know, if I went to Samoa, it's just like, oh, you look a bit different. You know, we know you're Fafa Fingi.
Yeah.
But we're not going to, whereas here, it's just, there's this focus on to be, or to look like, or to emulate this kind of persona. Yeah. And if you don't, it can be quite a harsh reality.
I think I've been guilty in the past, and like when I've spoken to people, that concept of passing. We're so guilty of critiquing trans women on their looks, asking stupid questions like, have you had this done? Have you had that done? And it can be so taxing on that, on trans people to have to answer those questions every day. And even going back to always having to ask if you're safe. Like, that's the question that you have to ask yourself every single day. And I hate that for you. And but going, it goes back to when I was saying that we have privilege. I feel safe enough to speak up for myself and other people. And it's so sad that you don't feel that way in certain situations. And I don't think people truly understand that about you.
Yeah, it's a hard one, because people, you know, sometimes people go, oh, but why are you getting angry? You're that angry black woman. And I just said, oh, my anger is validated. Look at the way my people have been treated. Look at the way mm-hmm. we've been colonized. Look at the way trans women of color are treated. You know, I have every right to be angry. You know, I choose to show my anger in different ways, and that's what feels good to me. But, you know, to keep constantly being on top of our game and this expectation that we're not supposed to be angry or, you know, I just tell people straight up, you're allowed to be angry, you're human, yeah. You know, some, but you know, you get these ones that go, oh, you know, you can't be angry. And, you know, sometimes I get it, from our Balangi people that, oh, but, you know, and I've had to, I've even had to navigate that yep. in LGBTIQ spaces. And I'm at the point where I'm sick and tired of, you know, having to tone it down for the simple fact is, you know, this is, you know, cis white people trying to tell me to tone it down.
Because you're being aggressive.
Yeah, or you're being the angry black woman.
Yeah.
And I just said, did you not hear what I just told you?
You can say it in the most calmest of tones and...
Yes.
They will still take it like you're attacking them.
Yeah, I mean, it's incredible. So me, I just say, if I've got to say it, I said it. I really don't care if they hate me for it. I just said, oh, well, that's one less hater.
Yeah.
You know, but it's just these things as of, oh, you know, I am the type of person like, oh, no, let's work on this together and we'll see what we can. Not this one way, it's your way, you know, their way, or it's the highway. And I just think, you know, and when I look at the person that said that, I said, oh, so typical of the Balangi to do that, mm-hmm. you know, and I'm so over that kind of, you know, that methodical approach to, oh no, you're a brown person, you should keep your voice down. And I just said, no, we shouldn't,
mm-hmm.
you know,
absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's been my experience too, at like work and things like that. I've kind of, I'm not the most like outspoken person in professional setting. But when I have to go there, I will go there. And I think it shocks people because they're just like, wait, where did that come from? But we have so much pent up anger that we should be able to express it without people feeling threatened.
Yeah, just validate it. Like, you know, I say to people, they're allowed to be angry. We don't need to agree with their anger. But mm-hmm. for them just to say that, look, I'm really angry. I said, yeah, you're allowed to be angry.
Yeah.
You know, they, you know, I just said, you know, that's, I feel that's been one of the problematic things for us in the past.
Yeah.
From my own way of being brought up is like, you know, don't talk, you're only young and da 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 da.
Yeah.
So, you know, what does that instill? You know, whereas now it's just like, no, I've had enough. I've got to say something. I've got to speak up. I've got to stand up. You know, as we've seen in the Western context, otherwise we'll just get walked all over.
Exactly.
You know? And the Balangis generally don't care. They're just they don't.
Like, they could be your best workmate and they're just like, anyways, had to step on you to get there.
Oh, it's just like how you said, you know, when you do speak up and they get a shock.
Yeah.
You know, and I was telling somebody about my course experience and they got such a shock that I spoke up, you know, to the security guard and I said, you know, I sidelined them and I just said, yeah, that's because I've had enough.
Yeah.
You know?
Exactly. You can only take so much.
Well, you know, just to even validate it, I just said, no, I want to validate that I'm angry. You know, I want my feelings of angerness to be validated, so I'm going to say it. Okay, two flicks up in deformation. You know what I'm saying?
I love
it. You know. Yeah, I tell you about it.
That's ridiculous.
Yeah.
Oh, can I ask? So we did talk about dating a little bit before.
Yeah.
Are you actively seeking out partners, or is it still a very challenging thing for you, as we did mention earlier?
I'm open. I'm a proud pansexual person here. Even that would throw some people. They're like, what? Pansexual, yeah. Pacific Islander, what is that? I said, oh, no, that's how I feel. That's what's important to me, honey.
Yeah.
I'm quite open. But, you know, just in the back of my mind, I think to myself, okay, how am I going to navigate this? And I think to myself, oh, that it's quite a challenge, the fact that I even think that. But it's just what I need to be aware of because of myself. You know, if we didn't have, you know, negative connotations the way that people were towards people like myself, then maybe I wouldn't have to keep asking myself those questions of, saying, I try to look at it in a positive way in that, you know, I try to use positive things that, you know, kind of put the context for myself in a positive way. Otherwise, if I keep hammering myself and go, oh, you know, it's not going to do me any justice. So I try to feed my mind good stuff or a good way of framing it just so that it's not heavy for me to take on board. You know, like saying to myself, oh, I so deserve the love today, you know, in each and every day, you know, saying that kind of, you know, reminding myself that it's okay to be loved, you know, instead of going with the attitude as, or I need to put on a particular piece of clothing or I need to have a knife, you know, just to look out for who's going to attack me or whatever. Yeah. You know, that's not a nice way of thinking. So, yeah, but it's... it's just, I think if there was no discrimination towards us, then it would be a lot more safer. It would be a lot more, I could think a lot more positively in the way of reaffirming myself that it's okay to date. But it's just what it is. And it's like, you know, I just have to put in those safety precautions to safeguard myself. You know, I feel okay to
choose. Oh, I think it's a bit frozen at the moment.
Potential partner now because I'm.
Oh, did you want to say that again? Sorry, it cut out there.
I know what I want. You know.
Hello.
Have you got? Yeah. Oh, I know. You know. I feel. Yeah, I'm here. Can you hear me? Hello.
Yeah, I can hear you, but you're frozen.
I'm here. Oh. Yeah.
We'll just see if it passes.
Okay. I'm a lot more clearer.
I think it's working now.
Yeah. As I was saying before, I'm a lot more, I feel a lot more stronger, a lot more confident in who I am. So, you know, in terms of a partner wise, I know who I want and I feel confident. Even to walk away from a partnership, I would be okay because I would still feel, I would feel so comfortable in my skin.
Yeah. You know, that.
Yeah, so, you know, and that, you know, coming back to that thing of love, how can you go wrong if you've got it set in your mind frame and in your heart, you know, can't go wrong with things like that.
Yeah, and even like dating as a trans woman and the challenges that comes with like the men, they won't admit that they're attracted, and I think that's where a lot of the issues come from, because they don't want to acknowledge that they are attracted to trans people, and then that's where a lot of the murders happen in the States.
The challenge I find is society's attitude towards trans people. If we didn't have the discrimination, then I don't think this whole onslaught of people fearing dating trans would be, because we also have to take into account the person that may be potentially interested in a trans.
Mm-hmm.
They have to navigate that. And, you know, I think to myself, it would be a challenge for them as well, because they may not be used to it. You know, like back in the heydays for me in my early transitional period, and being so excited to hook up with men or whatever, and not realizing sometimes, you know, be seen as a fetish.
Yep. But
back then it was even more worse, because they would do it undercover, or they would, you know, it was almost like you would be giving each other secret codes.
Yeah.
You know, so that, you know, they wouldn't get caught out knowing that they were going to have, you know, meet up with you. You know, like, that's just, yeah, that's challenging. So, yeah, now it's a lot more, but, you know, taking on board what you said, and also taking on board that, you know, society, you know, society and the discrimination or the negative connotations that they have towards people, you know, that is relayed to, you know, the way that potential partners. I really take my hat off, like I was saying to my friend yesterday, to men that are so comfortable in their skin to actually openly date trans women.
Yeah.
Or say someone that is openly open to dating a trans woman, because it's a lot of work. Like, you know, you're put in the limelight, and it's just like, you know, I was talking to another friend the other day, and she's Asian and her partner is Balangi, and what they had to go through to tell his family, you know, was like, my God, that's so huge to go through.
Yeah.
So it's one of the things that would be in the back of my mind if I would go into a dating situation, is navigating that space. And when I look at it, I just think, even now, if I had to look at the dating situation, I'm not too sure if I have the energy to, continuously explain, you know, it's that case of what do I disclose? And if, you know, if I don't disclose, am I cheating them in any respect about everything? Like, that's just me, like, with regards to myself or my position. But, you know, it's just like, well, what if, you know, I think one of my ultimate fears was, you know, when I was dating, was, will that person use it against me?
Yeah.
You know, because you've left yourself open.
Yeah.
You know, to someone being in your life, and you're scared that they could just go and use the trans thing. I think that's one of the things that I feared when I was dating.
Yeah.
Was that the person that I would date would use it against me, because I just said, oh, I would be so upset if that was the case.
Yeah. And I think there's a lot of mental work that you would have to do on your own to kind of accept your own womanhood, so that, you know, some people will stay in those relationships and take that every single time it's thrown at them. And be so unsafe for themselves. So that would be a whole challenge on its own.
Oh yeah. It's just like the last relationship that I had for 10 years. And I was just grateful that he never used the trans thing in any disagreements. But it's in the back of my mind, because, it's just like I said, the way society is, with trans people,
you can only see
why people would hide, or people, it's just that, because people want to be safe. They don't want to, you know, be discriminated against constantly, which is just really challenging.
Yeah. What are the misconceptions about being trans that bother you the most?
What are the misconceptions? I'm not too sure. Probably that we, you know, that we should succumb to doing low grade work, or be, you know, not having any aspirations, that we should do, you know, we should be given whatever we're given, you know, we shouldn't have things that will enhance our careers, you know, we should have the, you know, like just the rights as other people.
I think for me, what I've heard the most about trans people, and the argument that that transphobic people have, is the bathroom situation, and that irks me so much, because you know, think they say that they just want to be in bathrooms with little girls and do kind of like bad things to them.
It's really silly. And then when you see the people that have been locked up have been cis straight men,
exactly,
you know, it's I think one of the misconceptions is what people perceive the physical biology of what a trans woman should have, you know, and it's the toing and froing, and seeing some of the nasty comments when people see, you know, like a trans story on TV, and or if a news channel decides to cover a trans story, and you can see, lo and behold, a group of people have just gone to town. Oh, she's not a woman. How can she be a woman when she's got da 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 da?
Yeah.
You know, those kind of misconceptions, you know, this misconception of what a female should be, this misconception of what a male should be, you know, and as we've seen, it's, you know, biology is not black and white, you know, the, you know, being male or female is not just black and white.
No.
You know?
Yeah.
So those kind of misconceptions, you know, to do with the physicality, yeah, quite challenging to hear, especially when people are arguing and they have no idea, or they're not even from your community, and you're sitting there and they're just, you know, and the hate, the hate that I see when things like that, talks like that, is huge. Like, you know, so it goes back into the mindset of trying to protect one's, you know, oneself.
Mm-hmm.
Excuse me.
You're right.
So, yeah.
I think a lot of the physical aspect does have to do with choice, of course, and also access, because what some people can afford to do or want to do is different to what another trans person can do for themselves to kind of get the look of passing. And I think that's what we as a community, even the gay community, that's something that we need to unpack and unlearn as well, because it's very rife in the gay community. We're always praising trans women for passing, and then not doing the same for the rest of the community.
I even, you know, even in the gay, like within gay men themselves, because once upon a time being a gay man myself, you know, back in the days, you know, being the only colour or only Pacific Islander in a group of white men, and, you know, this obsession to look a certain way, or to... you know, be toned a certain way, even that in itself is quite problematic in terms of, you know, being inclusive of, you know, the diverse physical bodies that are out there.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, totally.
A huge problem there.
Yeah. Yeah, I find the same thing. Because I'm not the smallest person either. And so being in spaces with other gay, specifically white gay men, is not easy. But yeah, I think we're wrapping it up now. But what was some advice that you had for our young trans and just queer Pacifica people?
Just might sound cliche, but just keep loving yourself. Just keep being yourself. Keep living in your power. Do your research. Do your homework. Know that there is a place for you on this world, in this society. And just know that you're loved. Just know that there are a group of people out there that do love you. But yeah, just continue to be yourself, because at the end of the day, you're going to grow older. You're going to be who you are, and you just have to keep evolving. And I think just keep doing what makes you happy. Be a good person. It gets you far. And just continue to live in your power.
Thank you so much. So I just want to say again,
thank you.
Thank you for being on the podcast. I don't know if I mentioned before, but I've wanted to have you on for the longest time. I've been a quiet admirer of yours for quite some time now as well. And I hope people continue to give you your flowers that you so well deserve.
Thank you so much for having me. It's been a pleasure and an honor. I was just like, I can't believe you called. I was just like, yay. I was always been in the back of my mind like, oh, I hope I get an invitation. Hello.